KaiserNetwork.org.
Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome our producer for the Global Health Working Group, Daniel Stone from America Speaks.
Thank you very much, and welcome to the start of the first session of the Global Health Working Group. We at America Speaks are delighted to be back with the Clinton Global Initiative again this year to help produce the interactive portion of the Clinton Global Initiative. Now, CGI is a unique kind of conference in many ways. Certainly the people that come here make it unique. The panelists, the presenters, the speakers, all are part of the uniqueness. The emphasis on making personal commitment to the issues, walking out of here, also makes this for a very unique event. Another aspect of this event that participants last time said made it particularly unique was the emphasis on the interactive portion of the event that takes place in the working groups. So I want to spend just a couple of minutes with you, sharing with you how this is going to work. Because in most conferences, we really rely on the people on the stage to stimulate us and educate us. But here, in addition to relying on our panelists and moderators, we're relying on one another to share your expertise, your ideas, your experience, to be a major part of what we take with us out of this experience. So I'm going to share with you how the sessions are designed. Each session is composed of two sub-sessions, each of which has a different focus. And each sub-session will last about an hour and a half, and all the sub-sessions will have a very similar format. The sub-sessions are divided into three segments. In the first segment, the moderator and the panelists will come to the stage, and they'll share with us their views about the particular topic of that sub-session. Now, as they talk, you may have some questions that you would like to pose to them. And if you do, I would ask you to take one of the little pieces of paper that's on your table, jot it down, and hand it to the person who's sitting in front of the laptop. That person is what we call the facilitator, and I'll come back to them in a moment. But as you hand that to them, they'll enter that into the computer and will capture your questions. At the end of the first segment, we'll then turn to you, and I'll come back on the stage, and I'm going to pose to you a question that we would like you to discuss at your tables. You're going to have about half an hour for that discussion, during which time the facilitator at your table is going to lead you through the discussion. They'll help keep it focused. They will help make sure everybody stays engaged in the conversation. They will also be entering into the laptop some of the essential ideas that you come up with. As they enter those ideas, they're going to be sent back to what we call our theme team, which is in the back corner to your right. And the theme team is a group of policy analysts who are very quick at turning around ideas, synthesizing them. So that at the end of the table group discussion, they will have been through all of your comments. So the third part of the subsession will bring the moderator and the panelists back to the stage. At that time, they will first start out by addressing some of the questions that you had posed in the first part of the subsession. Then Chris Jennings, the working group chair, is going to come back to the stage, and he's going to review with us the major themes that came up in your table group discussions, as well as a few what they felt were unique or creative or particularly provocative ideas they want to share with you. And then for the last part of this subsession, we'll have the moderator and the panelists comment and respond to your ideas, and that will close out that subsession. Each subsession will follow a similar format. So the real idea here is for you folks to stay engaged yourself and really take advantage of the expertise of every single person at your table, making sure you get a chance to hear from everybody during each of these conversations. So I want to encourage you to have a great time with this. Be engaged, and hopefully this will stimulate your own thinking about what are the commitments you personally want to make by the time CGI is over. So with that, I'm going to leave the stage, and we'll bring on our moderator and panelists.
Please welcome our panelists, Paul Farmer, Julie Louise Gerberding, and Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus. And our moderator, Sanjay Gupta.
Thank you very much. You guys hear me okay? Standing room only. There's some more seats over here if anybody wants to sit. I think there's some more seats available. I'm delighted to be here. I get a chance to talk about global health issues quite a bit on CNN, but it is rare that I get an opportunity to actually meet with a group of people like yourselves and our panelists to actually talk not just about the problems, but about the solutions as well. And that's a lot about what we're going to be doing today. I'd just like to take a moment to thank Chris Jennings, Chris Dowell, and his team for putting this together. It's not easy to do. Lots of different issues we're going to get through. A lot of that is due to them, so thank you guys. When you talk about solving global health problems, you talk about the human needs, you talk about money, you talk about bricks and mortar. Collectively, these things are known as infrastructure. And some global health problems, no doubt, are difficult and complex to address, but some are more simple, relatively speaking. They're affordable, and they're easy to replicate. But sometimes the lack of infrastructure stands in the way of success. And that's a lot about what we're going to be getting to today. That's a theme that's going to run throughout the discussion this afternoon. Someone once said that if the cure for AIDS came in the form of a clean glass of water, we still couldn't rid the world of AIDS. And I think that speaks volumes about the lack of infrastructure in some places. We'll get at that as well. Infrastructure, again, is the human, physical, and institutional components of a healthcare system. It is the lifeblood of a healthcare delivery system as well. Yet tens of millions of people die every year because of infrastructure gaps, gaps in infrastructure specifically. A large component of that, as we will talk about, is the human element. And what does that mean? Severe shortages of physicians, nurses, healthcare workers in many places around the world. Globally, the shortage is about 4.3 million doctors, nurses, midwives, healthcare workers. Get this, Africa suffers the most. While they have about 25% of global disease burden, only about 1.3% of the world's healthcare workers actually work there. I thought that was remarkable. And of course, these conditions are made even worse by poor economic conditions. And in some cases, the accusations of poaching of human resources, which we will talk about as well. Bricks and mortar are equally important, something we're gonna mention. And oftentimes it's weaker in developing nations. How specifically, we will address. Health facilities are often concentrated in urban centers, leaving more than half the developing world unable to access their care. So a lot of times it's available in an urban center, maybe even not that far away, but still, many people in rural villages can't access some of that life-saving care. Many clinics have less than basic laboratory facilities. This inhibits frequent testing, for example, that's needed for HIV patients, impedes proper diagnosis of treatable tuberculosis, and it hinders effective disease surveillance as well. All of the components that are important for an equally effective healthcare delivery system. Simply getting drugs from manufacturers to people who need them the most has become very difficult in many parts of the world. But it's a fixable problem, and we're going to be talking about those solutions. During the session, we're going to talk about not only why we have the infrastructure gaps, but how the best minds around can help overcome them. And that is in the spirit of which we lead this discussion. Like I said, we talk about these issues a lot. Today we get to talk about the solutions. And to accomplish that, we are joined by our panelists. First of all, Dr. Julie Gerberding. Many of you may recognize her. She's the director of the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. Some of you may not know that CDC, besides operating in the United States, also operates in 45 countries around the world. She leads all that. It's not an easy job, I know. We'll talk to her about that. Dr. Paul Farmer is the founding director of Partners in Health. He's also a practicing physician and a professor at Harvard Medical School. He's had a book written about him called The Man Who Would Save the World, Mountains Beyond Mountains. That's a pretty cool book. Won the Pulitzer Prize. Dr. Tedros, he likes to go by Dr. Tedros, is the Minister of Health of Ethiopia. He's best known for his tireless work to modernize the provision of health care in Ethiopia. He's done some remarkable work and can be held up as a success story, which we need to talk about in order to be able to have this discussion concretely. So please welcome our panel. Dr. Farmer, let me start with you. And as was mentioned, you know, we're going to be soliciting questions from all of you as well. So as the discussion goes on, if you have questions, give them to your facilitator. We'll try to get to many of them as we can. You've done something that a lot of people said couldn't be done. We just talked about the fact that, while you may have great healthcare in urban centers, you may not have that in rural areas. How have you tried to address that problem? Has it worked?
Well, you know, as you said, it's not...
Get your really microphone.
Oh, yeah.
I feel like I'm Oprah. I like that.
That would make me Oprah.
Well, Never mind. I'll stop there. Sanjay. Doctors bantering. You know, it's not a hypothetical problem, of course, as you said. It's the biggest problem that's facing us now. It's different than the problems that were facing us before. Things are in some ways better now. We have medications that we didn't have before. We have some funding that we didn't have before. But getting those interventions, I'll talk about AIDS for a second, getting it to rural areas remains really a serious, huge problem. I just came last night from Haiti, and it's a problem even there, which is so close to us. It's a big problem where we work with the Clinton Foundation in Africa. But there are solutions, as you said. One thing we don't have the right infrastructure, the point of this discussion. A lot of that is human. There aren't doctors and nurses. In Rwanda, for example, after the genocide, there were probably only 500 physicians in a country of 8 million people. But what we do have are a lot of people who need something to do and want something to do in healthcare education, and those are villagers. Most of them are peasant farmers. There's not enough land. And so what we've done is trained them to be, we call them accompagnateurs, but I don't think it matters what you call them. They help deliver care on a daily basis to their neighbors. And lots of good things happen. One thing, and I'm sure we'll talk about this, and I don't want to go on too long, is you don't want patients who have active tuberculosis, which is about half of the HIV patients who we see in many of the places we work. You don't want them in the health centers coughing on women there for prenatal care and kids there for vaccinations. So you're changing this into an ambulatory system that happens at home with neighbors. And I think lots of other good things happen too. I mean, I don't want to focus too much on Rwanda, but a lot of very terrible things happened there 15 to 12 years ago. And to see neighbors helping each other is another way of delivering more effective care, making sure that you address unemployment, making people able to adhere to complex regimens on a daily basis, and really starting a virtuous social cycle whereby neighbors are helping each other. So I think that's one part of the infrastructure problem that we can address if we're willing to, you know, not pay people for their labor, to make sure that they also can feed their families if they're going to do this work. So that's how we did it.
And Paul, I'm going to ask you, I won't ask you to answer now. We're in a room of committers here, people who are going to make a commitment to this. What would you ask of them and of this initiative? Later on, we'll get to that. Okay, Dr. Tedros, I mentioned one of the statistics that I found alarming, and that's why I mentioned it in the opening remarks, that 25% of the global disease burden is in Africa, yet only 1.3% of healthcare workers. You've tried to help overcome that disparity in Ethiopia. How did you do it, and is it working? Grab your microphone there.
I think I will focus on the first, you know, we have identified some four focus areas based on the major problems that our country faces. And one is maternal health, second is child health, HIV/AIDS with TB, and then malaria. So these were the focus areas. Then we have said to address this, the best approach would be primary health care, because most of our problems linked with this are actually communicable diseases. And apart from, you know, whatever we have in relation to maternal health and child health, so we have said primary health care would be the best thing to focus. And the next step was to really identify the workforce that can really help with our primary health care. And we have identified the type of strategy we need to follow in order to satisfy the human resource needs. And the strategy that we identified is flooding and retention strategy. And when we said flooding and retention strategy, this is meant specifically for the workforce that we're going to use for the primary health care. So basically, these are low-level and mid-level health extension workers. So we have set targets that can really be achieved in, you know, as soon as possible to cover as many places as possible. And when I say primary health care, it focuses mainly on rural areas, and to really train the health extension workers and the other categories, nurses and health officers, based on that category. So I think the focus led us to really concentrate on the kind of health workers that we need to address our problems.
And so you were able to prioritize to some extent. What advice, I mean, would you give to other ministers of health, specifically in Africa, to try and be able to recruit and retain healthcare workers to overcome this disparity? I mean, how do you get them to stay?
Yeah, I think one thing, I think based on the priorities, if you identify the task force, then what is important next is to really train as many as possible. For instance, to train 30,000 health extension workers, we need, for instance, 30,000 health extension workers by 2008. This is blanket coverage, 2 health extension workers per village. And we have already trained and deployed 9,900. So one of the key elements we used to train as many as possible was to really focus on existing assets, exploiting the existing asset. That's not like business as usual. If we do it the business as usual way, we would have first built nursing schools. But instead, we used technical and vocational training centers, the existing ones, to train our frontline health extension workers. So that was like a shortcut. We were able to train 9,900 actually in 2 years and deployed them. So the 30,000, achieving the 30,000 will be possible in the next 2 years. So using your existing asset, we shouldn't go like the business as usual, building colleges and then staffing them, keeping them, and so on. It takes time. So what do we have, existing assets that we can produce more in a short time so we cover, all our villages with the right category of health extension workers? And the other category, for instance, if I use health officers, we used our existing hospitals, again, existing assets, to train thousands of health officers. We used to train, for instance, enroll 200 or 300 per year before. Now we have enrolled this year alone 2,166. And this was possible because we used our universities and hospitals, existing hospitals, to train more, to take more using the existing asset. So my advice would be to look for existing assets in order to really train more rather than go using, the business as usual type. Then you can really increase your volume, you can increase your speed. Of course, you should take care of your quality as well to achieve any ambitious target that you can set.
That's good advice. Thank you. And I'll be asking the same question about what you would want the most out of this initiative and this group of committers. Dr. Gerberding of the Centers for Disease Control, what is the most unacceptable gulf between what is possible in healthcare and what is actually happening on the ground, in your opinion?
Well, there is the gulf of what we don't know, but I think it's worse to know and not be able to deliver on that promise. And so from where I sit, the most frustrating thing domestically and internationally is to actually have the knowledge, to have proof of principle in a specific location, but not be able to actually scale up and out that particular intervention because of lack of capacity and infrastructure. We have many challenges. At CDC, we've sort of defined 3 big ones. One of them is complacency, which is not a problem in this room, thankfully, but it is in some other areas of our country. The second is capacity and the fact that we can go and do an imprint project. Maybe we can do a footprint project where we've left enough sustainability so that in that location it can grow and thrive independent of ongoing support. But the true blueprint projects where you go, you learn something, and then other people can adopt that and build their own sustainable enterprise, those are few and far between and very, very difficult to accomplish without the kind of investment in infrastructure that we've been talking about here. And for us, the real, I think, solution to that problem is connectivity, which is the challenge that brings, friends like SARS to our doorstep in no time at all, but it's also an incredible opportunity to build the sort of networks that allow us to move knowledge and products and people and enterprises much more quickly into the global setting. Let me just give you an example. We're in 45 countries, but obviously we're pretty small and we can't possibly do very much even with the scope of our budget and our resources. So by building an infrastructure capacity for others to come in and work on a regional basis, like we've done in Kenya, in Guatemala, in Bangkok, in areas of the world where CDC is making its own infrastructure investments in laboratories, in our top scientists, our disease investigators, training intensely the personnel in those countries, learning from those personnel. Then we have a platform to innovate. Other people can come in and hit the ground running because our platform is there already in existence. They don't have to figure out how to get a computer in or how to move people around or how to get a motor pulled together. We kind of support the enabling capacity to facilitate the partnerships between the health ministries and the interested experts from other areas and much more rapidly scale up and out the capacity to get things done. Building the connectivity between our health ministries and governments or the WHO, building the connectivity between experts in academia and on-the-ground needs, building the connectivity between businesses who have enormous logistical capacity in these countries, and yet we're not leveraging that for the kinds of health infrastructure development that we're talking about. In some countries, CDC relies on international business persons to have situation awareness about emerging health threats because people are monitoring the absentee rates and they have such a strong stake in the health of their workforce. So I think from where we sit, building connectivity is the most important way to overcome the gap between what we know and what we could do if we had a delivery system. But it takes time and it takes the kind of human resource development that sort of the disruptive technology of health aids and people building health capacity from the ground up. We have a long way to go.
Do you think that the United States, as the richest nation in the world, does enough?
Well, I can tell you from where we're sitting that whatever anybody is doing, it's not enough. I mean, clearly there's a lot of unmet needs and a whole lot of work that should and could be done. I do believe that we've learned something very important in the last few years, and I'm not here to advertise the U.S. government as having a solution, but I do think that experience with PEPFAR taught us at least two things. One is that if you invest big, you get results. And the second is, if you set goals and are transparent about what you're doing and expect people to perform to a certain level, you'll be surprised what can be accomplished. And I will admit, when the PEPFAR concept first got raised, I was very skeptical. The numbers seemed too high, the process seemed too hard. I didn't think we had the infrastructure to be able to get anywhere. And I've actually visited one of the programs in Ethiopia, and they are so far ahead of our imagination because of the scale of investment, but also the fact that people are very capable of innovating and coming up with solutions if you just expect it to happen. So the lesson there learned is, we can't solve these problems through incremental programs. We have to be willing to be bold, to be big, and to really go in knowing that it's going to take a lot of resource. But if we do that right, in the long run, we'll come out ahead.
Dr. Paul Farmer, you know, you just mentioned you got back from Haiti last night. You work at Harvard and you work in Haiti. I wonder if you can just for a second take a step back and give people a sense who've never been to a place like Haiti, what it means to live in a place that has a healthcare structure the way it is right now. What does it mean for the average person in terms of what they can and cannot get, how they have to live their lives? Just what do you see down there?
Well, Oprah style. Although Oprah can't do brain surgery, so you're okay. You know, I'd like to say something good about Haiti too. You know, about the work that's been done there. It's led by Haitians, but it's not typical of rural Haiti certainly, because in the place that I left, and it would be embarrassing if after 25 years we didn't have something to show for it in terms of infrastructure. You know, there is a modern hospital system, linked to healthcare centers with a very strong community-based staff. So we do, you know, we've even done this, you know, I think I've told you this before, we even have done neurosurgery there. So, but that's the way the whole place should look. You know, that's what the country needs. For people living in an area where there is not, and this is public infrastructure, Sanjay, this is, you know, the public sector, just like what Dr. Tedros is talking about, that's been rebuilt. And it's been rebuilt with the kind of money that Julie's talking about also. That is, with some AIDS money, which we have, you know, we follow the rules, okay, but we leverage, right. And we said, can we use this new interest in AIDS to strengthen primary health care? Because a lot of people thought you couldn't do that. And that's another bit of good news that I would add to Julie's list, is that not only can people do it, and not only are they able to do it, and it's hard, but it's doable, but you can also have lots of collateral benefits from this kind of intervention. Unfortunately, what life is like for most people in a rural village in Haiti or in Malawi or in Rwanda is, you know, there's no mosquito net. When you're sick with malaria, you don't have access to care. If you're in, you know, childbirth is the most threatening, life-threatening thing that a woman can face, is having a child. And, you know, the scandal of all this, of course, is that, you know, as is the purpose of this meeting, all of this has solutions. There's no question that the gap that Julie brought out is the one that's most frustrating to us, not a knowledge gap, but our ability to bridge this. So that's what I think, you know, the bottom billion in the world are facing these kind of problems. They don't have access to health care, and they don't have access to good prevention, meaning clean water, vaccines. Some vaccines they have, but plenty of others don't. So the Harvard-Haiti trajectory, to me, has been for 25 years this jarring, three-hour trip between a place where there's, you know, a thicket of hospitals on every corner, and where the budget of a hospital, the one I work in at Harvard, is more than three or four times the entire budget of the nation of Haiti, 8 or 9 million people. One of Harvard's 20 teaching hospitals. And to a place where the big problem is food security and lack of access to care. I would like to say one thing, though, in that taking this model, including what Dr. Tedros talked about, of having community health workers go visit patients every day, since we're not on TV, my Harvard colleagues get very cross when I say that, say what I'm about to say. One of the things we've done, though, is say, well, how about we try and bring the Haiti standard of care up to Harvard and do a better job taking up chronic illnesses like AIDS in Boston by having community health workers there too. So that's another. We have lessons we can learn from places like Ethiopia or Haiti if the resources are there to launch these programs.
That's a great point, and so you've been able to actually translate some of those lessons, and because people living right around you in Boston may benefit from those as well. 25 years ago, how many years ago, you started in Haiti. Let me just ask you real quick, not to get too personal here, but why did you do it back then? What prompted you to get involved in Haiti? As I mentioned in my opening remarks, people were saying you wouldn't be able to do what you've done down there.
Well, I mean, at that age, who knows why you're doing things. I would add that, the director of Partners in Health, who's here in the room today, she was also there 25 years ago, though she doesn't like that said because it makes her look too old. But, but the thing that the reason for going there, I had met some Haitians as a kid growing up in Florida and got interested in problems in our country, migrant farm worker access to care, for example. A lot of people in California, Texas, Eastern Seaboard know about this problem. You know about this problem. So that's how I got interested. But the drama of life and death, and knowing, again, to quote Julie again, knowing that there is the tools that we have already at hand, and this is 25 years ago, could have prevented these deaths, taught me something that I'll never forget, and that is that even if we develop new tools, which we need to do, we need new vaccines. We don't have a vaccine for any of the big three, malaria, TB, HIV, but even if we have them, unless we develop an equity plan to make these available to people living in poverty, those who need them most, we're going to have a stockpile of new tools that we are not able to use effectively in really poor places.
Dr. Tedros, sort of keeping along that same theme, in terms of things that you would like to have in Ethiopia, you know, in this room here, again, a room of committers, people who are interested, very interested in what you have to say, what do you ask for? What do you want?
Yeah, I think as you may... Many of you know, I mean, the maternal mortality in Ethiopia is really high. And as I said earlier, we're training health officers, thousands of health officers. By the way, this is as part of the strengthening the health systems, and it's supported by the, it's done by the Carter Center, by the way, and I would like to thank them for that. It's really something that can make a difference for our health system. Then from these 5,000 health extension workers, we would like to train by 2010. We're going to graduate by then. We would like to train 700 of them. That's like one person representing 100,000, means 70 million, to train them on emergency surgery. So the current training of the sales officers on public health for 3 years will be followed by up to one year emergency surgery training. We don't have enough surgeons in our country. And we shouldn't wait until we get the proper surgeons. So we have opted to train the sales officers, non-doctors, on emergency surgery. We have already piloted and tested it. It works well. My wish is if we can get funding for this training of the 700 health officers and nurses on emergency surgery, and they can do cesarean section, because we are setting up a very strong community-based intervention. But to save mothers, not only strong community-based intervention, you need good facility-based intervention as well. And at least a cesarean section should be done at health center level, which is part of the comprehensive obstetric care. So this could be like a complement to what the Carter Center is doing, to train those guys again on emergency surgery so they can do life-saving interventions, training the non-doctors on emergency surgery. And, of course, with that comes equipment. Means we may need to equip minimum of 700 health centers. And we're talking about, equipment for the operation theater. So if these two, and this lies within the priority areas which I said, the maternal health, which is one of the top of the four priority areas. And we would like to make really a difference. And if we can get support on this, would be a huge support. And I would like actually to suggest if any kind of support can focus on strengthening the health system like this one, that can really make a difference, because we have lots of funding for vertical programs like HIV/AIDS or malaria. But unless we increase the caring capacity of the health systems, our health system, which is already weak, may even collapse. So that's why we ask more support on health systems like logistics, for instance, which, the first one is a bit difficult. Maybe I can go for a second one, a logistics system, which is a huge intervention also to really increase the provision of essential drugs in the country, a revolving drug fund.
Maternal health, emergency surgery, the ability to do cesarean sections, the equipment needed to train doctors to be able to do these things, and the infrastructure. Of course, Dr. Paul Farmer, same question. What keeps you up at night? What would you like to ask people to give if they could?
I think that what keeps me up at night is we need to be bolder about how broad these interventions are. The terminology that Dr. Tedros just used, he talked about, we said we're well-funded for AIDS and malaria. Again, these are what public health people call vertical programs. We have to be able to take those resources, which are new. I mean, he wouldn't have been able to say that 3 years ago. I mean, this funding is new. We have to be able to take that and render it horizontal. We have to make it available for primary health care, for modern obstetrics, for a broad range of interventions. And that I think we can do. But in order to do that, and to do it in the places that are the most difficult to reach, to go for the gold, the rural regions of Africa, for example. Look at all the NGOs and interventions. They tend to be in urban areas. If we're going to go for the gold and really go to these poor places that are, I don't want to name names of countries, but if you look at where the biggest foundations are investing, they're investing in middle-income countries that are considered by Americans to be developing countries. But there's a huge difference inside Africa or South America or Asia between a country with a decent healthcare infrastructure and these really very poor countries. That's where we should do it, and we have to link this improved implementation in these centers of excellence or these networks of excellence to a veritable science of implementation. And that's going to require training, some new research, and some new tools. And that is going to be, since we're in a room full of committers, it's going to be an expensive exercise in a sense, nothing compared to the kind of stuff that gets wasted, destroying infrastructure. But it's something that we can do. We have strategies, but we need backing. We need, and we need some unconditional love is what we need.
Um, Dr. Gerberding, as you survey the playing field of global health in the United States and 45 other countries, what do you wish you had?
I think I would just say the same thing that I just heard from my colleagues. We need a knowledge distribution system. We need to somehow be able to take the kinds of technology that made the world flat or the connectivity that made the world flat and use them in innovative ways in the areas that aren't flat yet. That may be people. That may be a cell phone in the hands of the health aide in the rural area who can reach back to the county and get information or reach back to the tertiary care center and get a consult. We have such extraordinary innovation, but we aren't innovative about using it in the poorest areas of the world or the poorest countries. So if we could figure out how to redistribute our knowledge, and it is more than one direction, we learn as much as we contribute, I really think we could accelerate the solution to the problems. But fundamentally, we're all saying the same thing. We know what to do, but we can't develop the systems to deliver on that in the places that need it the most.
Okay. Thank you very much to our panel. That ends this part of the discussion, the first 30 minutes. I'm going to invite Daniel Stone to come back up here for America Speaks to guide us through the rest of the afternoon.
All right. Thanks very much. So we've heard from our panelists and our moderator how essential it is to build and develop the healthcare infrastructure, be that training, be that logistics systems, delivery systems, and so on. But the question is how to go about making this a higher priority so that this actually happens. So the question that we would like you to focus on is, what strategies could better ensure that the development of healthcare infrastructure becomes a priority for corporations, NGOs, policymakers, and the public? And once you identify those strategies, what needs to happen to actually put those strategies into effect? You've got 25 minutes for this conversation. Have a great conversation, and we'll be back up here.
All right. We're back. They say doctors are always late. I wonder where they get that from. Okay, we've got some great questions that have come in. What we plan on doing now is these are some of your questions. We're going to try and address those to our panelists. And also, we got Chris Jennings hard at work back there looking at some of the themes. He's going to be presenting those in a few minutes as well. We'll get to that. Let's get right into some of these questions, though. And let me go straight to you, Dr. Tedros. You often hear the lack of absorptive capacity in developing countries as an excuse for missing key milestones in global health. Is that real, first of all? Is that your experience? And what can donors and NGOs do to improve local capacity?
I think the absorptive capacity, I can agree. I mean, there is low capacity. And partners should be involved in building capacity. For instance, one of the projects we have with Clinton Foundation is Hospital Management Initiative. And that builds the capacity of hospitals. And I would like to use this opportunity, actually, to thank the foundation. On the other hand, there is some misconception, actually, in terms of absorptive capacity. Many people think that we should do everything ourselves. Like, for instance, there could be weaknesses in procurement. I don't think we need to do procurement ourselves. You can hire a procurement agent. I can give you one example. Recently, for instance, there was a memorandum of understanding signed between PEPFAR and Global Fund to create synergy, which is really excellent. And we have asked our Global Fund partners if they can help us compress the fund, which is 2006 to 2008 fund in one go, you know, to ask it in 2006. We revised our targets and they said, why not? So we revised our targets and most of the things were like the problem we were stuck with was, you know, procurement. We outsourced that. So we are now doing everything that we were supposed to do actually until 2008 in 2006, and the targets we were supposed to achieve in 2008, we're achieving them now. So the whole idea is, one, you can build your capacity, but on the other hand, I think you don't need to build your capacity on the things that you can outsource to others. So you can really outsource many of the things, and you can even go fast, and we're trying to see it in that respect, in really outsourcing in order to absorb more, and it's working well. Thank you.
Great. Thank you. Dr. Paul Farmer, if we fail to build an effective infrastructure, this is another question, what are the threats not only in developing countries but to the rest of the world as well? You started getting into this a little bit, but also if any case examples, say avian flu.
Well, you know, I think there are threats that we don't talk about a lot, and maybe this is not the forum, but obviously there are moral threats, that is the threat of not coming to the assistance of those in need. It's not an insignificant thing for doctors to consider, of course. I know that's not what you had in mind, but as a fellow clinician, I think, you know, we shouldn't give up that ground, you know, that moral obligation to do something good. You know, we don't, whether in public health or surgeons, or I think we can hang on to that too. But let me give another threat. I know it's on Julie's mind, and on, you know, there are other people here like Peter Small who are expert in this. There are. You know, the problem of drug resistance. Now that may seem very arcane in this group, but if you think about 60 years ago, almost all staph isolates, staph aureus, you know, the stuff you hear about in the hospital that's on your skin, all susceptible, could be killed by penicillin. Now it's about 5% in this country. Bacteria, parasites, viruses, they acquire resistance to the agents we deploy to fight them. And the way that that will happen most quickly is if there's poor adherence or compliance, as we used to say, with the drug regimens. That's what happens with AIDS. You give people the drugs, you sell them, they can buy them 1 month, they can't buy them next month. Of course they develop drug-resistant disease. That gets transmitted. Now the threat I want to mention, and very briefly, is drug-resistant tuberculosis. Just in May, we heard about, at the CDC, we had a meeting with the CDC and heard about what is now being called XDR-TB, extensively or extremely drug-resistant tuberculosis. It's airborne, and in the case from South Africa, which is right near where we work in Lesotho, the case fatality rate is that the number of people who died within 2 months was, I don't know, it was 90% or more. Was that right, Julie? Yeah. And we've seen this before, and we're going to see it again. So if we can't think of ways to have collaboration, rich country, poor country collaboration, in the case of South Africa and Lesotho, that's rich country, poor country, South Africa being wealthy, Lesotho being poor. But if we can't organize this ambitious effort that we've been talking about, that's the sort of threat I think that we're going to also see. You know, and I don't want to single out certain countries. I've worked in several countries where there is XDR-TB, and it's never contained by prison walls and homeless shelters and health hospitals. It spreads.
Paul, let me just follow up for a second on that, and specifically the first part of your answer. You talked about this moral obligation that maybe we have, and maybe that's more subjective. But when you're sitting around talking to your friends and you're trying to get them to care about building health infrastructures in countries that some of them can't even find on a map, how do you get them to care about that sort of stuff?
Well, I think that's in part the obligation of those of us who work directly, you know, in the field, as they say, doctors, nurses, people who are philanthropists who actually work in the field. It's our job to make this vivid and human to others. Sometimes we do that by saying, here, meet this person, actually bringing them. Sometimes we say, here, look at this person's story. Look at this person's children. This morning I went to Montefiore to give pediatric grand rounds to a room full of people, many of them young physicians, who they've never been to Africa, they've never been to Haiti, and you know they see the faces of these children, you know, one hopes before and after, and it makes a difference. So I think I'm just giving a couple of things in addition to those things we are required to do, which is to have sound analyses of epidemic disease or problems like maternal mortality, have the numbers right. And one of the things we've been doing recently with the Clinton Foundation is to get, you know, a model that people in business and philanthropy can understand how this works. But I think there's lots more we can do just to say, hey, this is a fellow human being, and you owe it to that person to care about this. And, you know, haranguing people and is not a good idea, I've learned. Guilt is not bad, though. Guilt is good. But, you know, humanizing, showing people the face of this suffering, I think, is something we also shouldn't let go of. You know, just because we're scientists or university presidents or teachers, we can also share what it means to be living in poverty and then face a devastating illness. I think we could do a better job. I mean, right. I shouldn't say that to you because that's what you do for a lot of people in this country and globally, but I think the rest of us also need to learn how to do that better.
Thank you. Dr. Gerberding, this next question I think is something that you think about a lot because I've heard you talk about that, but the question from the audience is this. How is it that soda companies and others can get their products to huts in the most rural villages across the world? Can these distribution systems be adapted, used in some way to solve global health infrastructure gaps?
I love the question. I'm living in Atlanta where we have one of those important software distributors. It's a fascinating process, and as I understand it, this is a microeconomy. In some communities, the person who is the soft beverage distributor is a very, very wealthy person. And so there's a very strong market for those beverages, and it's a self-perpetuating and a self-evolving system because it creates trade, income, status, and opportunity. So, having been up in the most northern part of Alaska and in some of the most remote parts of Africa and always having a Coke, I think they've been highly successful. And I guess, what can we learn from that? Well, one thing we can learn is that in order for a beverage company to be successful, they need clean water. You can't have Coke if you don't have clean water. So there's a very powerful principle there about the incentives for water supply and how can we do more to take advantage of a collateral opportunity. And the other is what can we co-market with the beverage? Can we put a bed net in the vending machine? Can we allow people to turn in so many soda tops and get a bed net or get something for their home? Or can we put clean water in the distribution system? So it certainly creates opportunities. And again, it's not that we don't know how to do it. It's that we can't take advantage of the knowledge distribution necessary to make it happen. And that's why the people in this room are so powerful, because I'm sure there are a lot of people here who have thought about this and probably could come up with some really good ideas on how to leverage the systems that do exist.
Okay, great. Well, we're honing down on this a little bit. I'd like to please welcome up Chris Jennings now. He's the working group chair. He's going to review some of the themes that that you've all come up with. Thanks, Chris.
Rat-a-tat-tat, we're moving here, guys. Thank you. I have to say I was skeptical about this process, but it is incredibly impressive what you produced. So it wasn't very hard to consolidate. We've collaborated and coordinated. Now we have three slides of common themes. By that I mean themes that we have heard in table after table that seems to be highlighted consistently, and we want to go through those. And then after I go through those, there will be three quick PowerPoint slides, and then I'm going to go through the nuggets, which is really reflective of one individual concepts that we didn't see replicate at all, but seem to actually be very consistent in the application of the themes. So why don't I start with the first slide? I love this technology; it's working. I'm Sanjay. I'm going to give you the papers
sure. So
you can look at that. Illustrate the value and outcomes of infrastructure. Oh, excuse me. What do we have here? Terminology matters. Except my technology doesn't work up here. Terminology matters. What this is, I think this is a really very important point, which is to say, infrastructure isn't capturing the word, capturing the concept in any way that means something to anyone. And the specific line was, it doesn't capture the human need. For example, it's about people. It's not about roads. It sort of sounds like roads and bridges rather than people. Secondly, corporations need to begin to recognize and are recognizing their own interest to build infrastructure for their own labor force and the communities for which they live. Thirdly, it needs, when we're talking about infrastructure investment, we're not just talking, when we're talking about spending big money in drugs or development of R&D or new products, part of that investment needs to be about how we deliver those products once they are available and how to rapidly distribute them. Can we go to the second one, please? The second slide is illustrate the value of outcomes of infrastructure investment in tangible ways. This was a theme that was stated over and over and over throughout the tables. People need to understand what the value is. Secondly, women. Women are the repository. of information about what's happening and how best to deliver healthcare, both in terms of educational and also direct delivery. And thirdly, individual communities want a sense of ownership, which is to say, I think what Dr. Tedros was saying, build up, don't build down. They need to be part of the process, and that will make it a much more successful and sustainable infrastructure. Third slide, please. Infrastructure development demands decades-long commitment by all partners. This came up a few times, which is to say, don't be unrealistic. This is going to take some time to do it right, and it has to be a sustainable commitment by all partners to get it done right. Secondly, widening the application of 21st century IT and communications technology. This is the idea of applying technologies to the extent we can in meaningful ways. Thirdly, the private sector must involvement has to extend beyond traditional orientation to the pharmaceutical world in terms of establishing an infrastructure that works. And lastly, I want to just highlight the nuggets that we thought were particularly helpful in this discussion. And I would call this more of sort of an application or extension of some of the themes. How do you make some of these things work? What we picked up in your discussions were that this is that we should create alliance and dedicated fund for infrastructure. Maybe be able to focus people on this issue and its meaningfulness in ways that captures the imagination, which I think runs very well to the second point, which is maybe a health corps that captures people's imagination, such as the Peace Corps or Teach for America has. And then in a specific application of the technology point on the themes, people said use telemedicine to provide specialty care in underserved areas where possible, where there are energy sources and other creative ways to do this. And lastly, let's not say that there's capacity in all areas, particularly in training healthcare workers. In India, I believe in Brazil and elsewhere, there have been very significant trends in increasing supplies of providers and care and multi-talented caregivers. You don't always think this is about the West. The West has been sucking talent. Some other people can actually apply it from country to country. With that, I'm going to close and turn it back and ask for some responses, other than to say that we captured as much as we can. We still have much, much more information in the back. I want to thank you all for contributing to this. It was really an amazing process. Thank you.
Thanks. And we just have a few minutes now to go over some of these themes. Let's try and dissect these down a little bit. If we can get the second slide back up, I don't know if we can get that. The themes infrastructure starts with illustrate values and outcomes of infrastructure. I thought that was interesting, and let me go to you, Paul Farmer. Illustrate the values and outcomes of infrastructure investment in tangible ways in order to educate funders. I want to dissect this down because I think this sort of strikes the heart of what we've been talking about for the last hour or so. You know, if you're making a pitch to your funders, if you're doing your pitch, which you have to do, I know, from time to time, Paul.
That's what I'm doing right now.
That's what you're doing right now. What is the value? I mean, how do you illustrate the value of actually developing some of the infrastructure that we've been talking about?
Well, as you point out in starting this, Sanjay, we're talking about infrastructure broadly, human, personnel. It's a confusing term, as someone must have noted, and also physical infrastructure. And in the dramatic places in which dramatically poor, I mean, that's what I should say, devastated by violence, no IT infrastructure. Actually, there's someone here today who taught us a lot about the importance of solar power in trying to light up a rural clinic. But in these very dramatically poor places, I think one of the ways to show funders how important this is to say, this is what it looks like now. This is what it could look like with a relatively limited investment. And then, X months later say, you see, we told you so. You can do this. I mean, when you came to visit us in Rwanda saw a hospital molting out of the, caterpillar form into, this is a bad metaphor. Anyway, being transformed into a beautiful hospital, I think it's dramatic, And so it's part of what we need to do, just like making the suffering, unnecessary suffering, vivid and compelling to people is to show that it can be done. Because as Dr. Tedros said, there are some myths out there about absorptive capacity too. You know, there's the idea that, you know, you can't do this in the really poorest places. It's just not true. It's difficult, but it's not true. So I think it's a very pedestrian response, but to say the proof is in the pudding, come look yourself, you know, and then trust us to continue this process. I have also argued here that infrastructure ought to be public infrastructure so that we can make sure that poor people have rights. You know, because NGOs and faith-based organizations and charities and foundations, they don't offer poor people rights. Only governments offer rights. So, you know, someone living in Ethiopia can only go to a public facility and say, I'm here for my right to a safe childbirth. You can't go to other places. So we need to build the infrastructure, show it can be done, staff it in a reasonable manner, and then show that this can keep on going over time. One last thing I'd like to mention about the brain drain, which was mentioned by Chris. It's true that the wealthy countries, what he called the West, are sucking resources out of Africa and many other places. But one of the reasons people leave is not because they want higher salaries, or it's because they want decent working conditions. A Kenyan doctor once said, you know, I didn't go to medical school to be a mortuary attendant. So unless we give them the tools that they need, you know, whether they're Indian generic medications, essential drugs, an operating room, in that infrastructure, then the human, it's horrible to say human infrastructure, then the personnel who we need are not going to stay. And once you do that, once you make a commitment, say this is a worthwhile investment, then they will stay. That's been our experience in both Haiti and Africa.
You know, it's been remarkable as well. You mentioned Rwanda, and I imagine there's a lot of anecdotes, Paul. You know, I met a woman at your facility, a Partners Health facility, outside of Kigali, who came in very, very ill. She had to be carried in. She looked like she was going to die because she was HIV positive and was just in the early stages of AIDS and developed an abdominal infection. Well, she was treated, and within my week's stay, by the time I left, she was actually discharged, happy and healthy and doing well. And I was struck by those sorts of stories that actually show the infrastructure, as you say, leading to someone not only surviving but able to carry on their way of life. And I think those sort of stories speak volumes. At the bottom of that same slide, Dr. Tedros, it says individual communities want a sense of ownership over their own infrastructure. I think it's an important point. I mean, so, you know, once you get the infrastructure, the ball doesn't stop there. You got to keep moving it down the field and make sure the people who are actually boots on the ground are engaged in that infrastructure.
Mm-hmm. Maybe may I say something on the previous one?
Yes, please.
You know, the infrastructure is very important. For instance, as I said, in order to reduce maternal mortality, you need to have community-based interventions and facility-based interventions. Unless you do that, you know, it has already been assessed by the World Bank. Actually, there was a study. Unless you do the facility-based intervention, you cannot reduce maternal mortality. So that's why. And I think funders should be convinced, okay, community-based interventions and giving pills or other maternal health activities can help, but it cannot be complete. So whatever we promise to mothers really cannot happen without infrastructure. That's what we have seen. And the second issue is, I think, with regard to, you know, infrastructure or strengthening the health systems, we're getting a lot of support. I mean, by the way, I would like to use this opportunity to thank all partners for this unprecedented support on HIV and malaria. We're very grateful for that. But unless we strengthen the health system, it will be really futile. Because if you consider the individual programs as loads of, you know, something to be carried by the health system, and if you consider the health system as a vehicle and try to really carry it, it can end up even crashing the health system. So there is a danger. And you cannot sustain anything, actually, because there is no carrying capacity. So unless we really strike a balance, whatever we're investing on malaria and HIV now will just disappear like never has been done. So that's why we say, let's strike a balance, strengthen the health system. And the ownership issue, we have ambitious targets, as I said earlier, and we're building health posts and health centers, and communities are getting involved in building the infrastructures. in terms of whatever they can actually contribute towards building health posts, building health centers. You know, they can bring sand, stones, and so on from the local areas. That, I think, ensures ownership. And also involving them from the very beginning, listening to what they say. I will tell you one focus group discussion we have done with mothers, for instance. We were telling them about, you know, contraceptive use, and they told us about their choices, you know, the type of contraceptive they need. They said, we need not pills, but we need, injectables, because husbands normally in Ethiopia don't approve taking contraceptives. You know, they associate it with extramarital affair and so on. So they take pill, when they take pills on daily basis, they cannot hide it from their husband. So they ask for injectables. And we asked that, we told them, you know, you should really, this is a family issue, you should discuss this openly, and the husband should be involved and so on. They said, yeah, don't be silly, you know, you cannot change their attitude overnight. You can help us, okay, educate them, but while doing that, we don't want more children, so give us the injectables or the shots. So we asked them, how do we do it? And they said, you know, when you come for your outreach vaccinations, you can give us, you know, the injectables at 3 months. So what I want to say is they know the problems and they know the solutions as well. They're not ignorant. Although they're from the rural, they know better than us. The issue of sustainability of or ownership is to just start from listening to them, discussing with them, ask them what they need, and build starting from that. Then I think the ownership issue can be addressed. So based on that, we're starting some programs that really is supported by them. So the ownership issue, if you really involve the communities, listen to what they say, listen to what their priorities are, that can suffice it. And I ask all our partners also to listen to our priorities. Thank you. And we are committed to listen to our communities.
Dr. Tedros, thank you very much. And unfortunately, we are running very short on time now. We tackled a difficult topic today. I think infrastructure is not an easy topic. Some people's eyes glaze over at the very mention of it, but it's an important topic to discuss. If you're going to have an informed discussion about healthcare, the global health problems, the hard ones, and the easy ones as well, you need to be able to be talking about infrastructure. You've heard about some of the commitments. You heard some of the definitions. And we leave it to you now to hear some of the commitments that you're going to make as well. Before we get there, though, we want to hear about some of the commitments that have already been made. With that, I'm going to say goodbye. We're going to excuse our panel, and thank you very, very much.
Ladies and gentlemen, Donna Shalala.
Thank you very much. Well, my eyes didn't glaze over. I get to introduce four commitments this afternoon, and let me start by inviting the President and CEO of U.S. Doctors for Africa, Ted Alemayehu. Is Ted here? One of the big infrastructure issues is, of course, the mobility of quality medical care, and U.S. Doctors for Africa is making an extraordinary commitment. Working in 9 countries in Africa, they will mobilize 200 mobile clinics with 2,000 medical volunteers to deliver high-quality services, particularly treatment for AIDS and other infectious diseases. In addition, they know better than just to go and leave. They're going to strengthen over 100 standing clinics in those communities. The value of this commitment is $75 million over 5 years. Let's congratulate Ted. A lot of people have had something to say about our multinational drug companies. Pfizer gets it. And please welcome Joe Fetsko, the Chief Medical Officer of Pfizer, and Robert Mallett, the Senior Vice President for Corporate Affairs. In much of the world, drugs are delivered not just through a formal process, but through an informal process, with lots of different people that community individuals buy their drugs from. And this proposal and this commitment is interesting for a multinational company because recognizing the informal system and building on effective collaborations with governments and NGOs and communities in Africa, they intend to improve the delivery of drugs for malaria by strengthening that informal system in Ghana, Kenya, and Senegal. They'll work initially in the informal system and then build from there. This is a $15 million commitment over 5 years. Please congratulate. Thank you very much. Got it. Okay. Could I introduce Craig Nakagawa, the COO of Village Reach? Most of us know the work. Please welcome Craig. Village Reach, of course, made their reputation and their work on immunization. They intend to build on that platform. 171 clinics where they've already improved the supply lines for vaccines, and they're going to take that knowledge, particularly in Mozambique, for infrastructure improvements, and they're going to expand that platform to maternal and child health, to family planning, to mental health, to school health, to nutrition, to AIDS, and leprosy, and TB, and target two provinces. They've done wonderful work at immunization. This expansion allows them to strengthen the infrastructure in Mozambique. The value is $3.1 million over 5 years. Congratulations, Craig. Thank you, Craig. And last but not least, let me welcome an old friend, Seth Berkley, the president and CEO of the International AIDS Vaccine Initiative. Hi, Seth. Everybody knows the International AIDS Vaccine Initiative. Seth and his colleagues have chosen India, because they have some infrastructure strength, an industry that's pretty sophisticated, and of course, world-class scientists. And there they will strengthen the quality of testing and counseling to prepare for the introduction of vaccines. India, of course, chosen because it has all of those kinds of combination. They have a global research and development capacity, a model for India, and that preparation will help us introduce what we hope will be successful vaccines and create a model for the world. $77.5 million commitment over 3 years. Please congratulate Seth Berkley. Please congratulate all four of the commitments. Thank you.